Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors.
Everyone, welcome back to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to begin by acknowledging and thanking the generous listeners who continue to support Talking Tudors on Patreon, and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. As an independent podcaster, this really does make a difference. If you love the podcast and you never miss an episode, I invite you to join the Talking Tudors Patreon community. Please visit patreon.com/talkingtudors for more information. When you join the patron family, you'll instantly unlock access to exclusive posts, including audio releases and videos. Patrons are also eligible to attend additional monthly live talks and to take part in a member-only book club. They can also enter patron-only monthly giveaways, to name but a few of the perks. You can also support the podcast and share your love of Tudor history with the world by buying Talking Tudors merchandise. There are a number of designs and products available, including phone cases, mugs, notebooks, and apparel. Check out all the products at talkingtudors.threadless.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the podcast to chat about her new book, 1000 Tudor People, is Melita Thomas. Melita is the co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a repository of information about Britain in the period 1485 to 1625. She's also the author of The King's Pearl and The House of Grey, and is a PhD candidate at UCL researching Mary I's networks. Her latest book, 1000 Tudor People, will be released on the 28th of March 2024. Let's dive straight into our conversation. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Melita. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you, Natalie, and thank you so much for inviting me to join Talking Tudors again. I have to say the podcast has gone from strength to strength since I last took part in it. You've really massively expanded and it's fabulous to be asked back.
Thank you so much. I have been looking forward to talking to you. Let's just start with an introduction because it has been a little while since you've been on the podcast. So would you mind just saying hello to everyone and telling us a little bit about you and your background?
Hello, everybody. I'm Melita Thomas. I've got a master's in historical research from London University, the Institute of Historical Research. And I'm currently working towards my PhD at UCL, where I'm in the early modern history department looking at Mary I and her social and political networks. I'm the author of two books previously, and this is the third one that we're talking about today. The first one's The King's Pearl, Henry VIII and his daughter Mary. Then The House of Grey, Friends and Foes of Kings. And my new one, which is 1000 Tudor People. I'm also the co-founder and editor of the online website Tudor Times, which hopefully some of you will have come across, and the co-author of the Tudor Times Books of Days series. Yeah, I've been quite busy in the last few years because I only started this as a second career.
You have been very busy, and the Tudor Times is a wonderful, wonderful resource. So I hope people have heard about it. So let's talk about 1000 Tudor People, your latest book. So can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write this? And also maybe tell us a little bit about how you've actually structured the work as well.
Well, there's sort of two strands of how it started. I don't know if you remember a few years ago, there were those lovely books, 1000 Places to See Before You Die, 1000 Villas to Stay in, really lovely glossy pictures, which were kind of comprehensive guides to whatever the thing they were talking about. And I thought that would be, you know, a fabulous thing to do for the Tudor age. And we talk about the kings and the queens and the politicians and Thomas Cromwell and all the rest of it. And they're all really interesting and sort of larger than life people. But actually, they didn't really impinge on everyday life any more than royalty currently does. There are many, many other people out there living their life, contributing to society, doing wonderful things. It was an age of discovery and of growth and of changes in knowledge. And there are just so many other people out there who I wanted to actually draw attention to. And also, you know, sites like the Tudors, you know, shows like that, they kind of make you cringe, but they also have characters and you think, well, who were they? You know, who was the Duke of Norfolk? Who was the Marquess of Winchester? What was their background? So I also wanted it to be a guide to some of the real Tudor people that you come across in books or series or movies, to give some facts, because what you see on things like the Tudors aren't always facts, I'm sorry to say.
No, not always, that's right. And so given that there are lots of people that we could talk about and that you could have included, how did you go about selecting the people?
Well, I thought it would be hard to find 1,000 interesting people, but actually there are dozens on the cutting room floor. I've got 250 lying in wait, should another volume ever be required, although I'm not sure that it would be. You have to have the kings and the queens and the famous politicians. But after I'd gone through that, so I did the monarchs and their consorts, then the royal family, and then the key politicians, so Cecil and Cromwell and Wolsey and Gardiner and the usual suspects. But then I picked some famous people from other walks of life. So I think Shakespeare, Drake, John Dee, I think were three of the first ones. And as I researched them, other people's names came up. So, for example, Shakespeare, then you've got the other players. You've got Ben Jonson and Kit Marlowe and Thomas Nash and Thomas Kidd. And as you worked out from them, more people came to light. So there's the Shakespearean, the people who own the theatres, Philip Henslow and his sons, some of the actors, the fool, Will, who walked to Norwich or danced all the way to Norwich. That was his claim to fame. He danced all the way from London to Norwich. And so you keep finding new people and then they lead you to other people. I wanted as many Welsh people as I could find, being Welsh myself and having a Welsh publisher. So I thought that would be nice. And again, a lot of the history we see is very Anglo-centric. So I did want to look at people who weren't just in the southeast of England, and particularly Welsh people. And I made a real effort to incorporate as many women as possible. Now, clearly women were not so prominent in society as they are now. And very often the only women you do find are in there because they were recorded, and they were only recorded because they transgressed in some way. So the women do look disproportionately criminal, I'm afraid to say, although they aren't, you know, there are other women who did interesting things. But I managed to get about a third women, which, you know, I thought was pretty good. There was no possibility of getting it to be 50-50, but I felt, you know, getting to a third wasn't too bad. And was probably reflective of everyday life. Women weren't necessarily as browbeaten as we think they were, particularly in the middle classes, the gentry class, where they were very active sort of economic members of society, and the merchants' wives and the women who ran businesses on their own account. So that was really how I tried to put them together.
Wonderful. And having had a little peek at the book myself, it's absolutely extraordinary. And it's so obvious that you've put in a lot of research and years, you were just telling me earlier, of research. So can you tell us a little bit more about that process, and also maybe talk a little bit about some of the sources that you used and some of the challenges perhaps that you also face, that we all face when writing our books, and even breakthroughs as well?
Well, I wanted to set the scene as well. So it's not just about the people. There's a section at the beginning of the book about the Tudor world. What was the world like for these people? And one of the reasons why the Tudor age is so interesting is the amount of change. I mean, in 1485, your life probably wasn't that different from your great-grandparents in 1385. By 1600, it had changed, not out of all recognition, but enormously. I mean, the Reformation clearly altered society from top to bottom. Printing, the increased availability of education, the new plants that came from the New World, the looking out towards the Americas, particularly for, and this is a book about Tudor, so it's England and Wales and Ireland, it's not Scotland, but the looking out to the West changed people's perceptions of their place in the world and their country's place in the world. There's a Whig version of history of the sort of isolationist nature of English society. And a lot of that began in this period, rather than the feeling they're part of Christendom. So I also wanted to think about everyday things. What do people eat? What was the money like? Why are they all called Thomas or John? And why are the women all called Elizabeth or Anne? There's even at the beginning there, I've got a little diagram of showing how frequently the names occur. So and what games did they play? So there's that first chapter. And of course, that required a lot of research across a wide range of books. I mean, a great one to read is Ruth Goodman's How to Be a Tudor. That's great fun. For the entries themselves, you can't, you know, I didn't want to just be doing a scrape of the internet and bad version of Wikipedia. So every single entry I've done has at least two academic journals or papers or books behind it, because if you just read one, then you get a very skewed opinion. So you need to read at least two different versions. And that's on top of the standard words like the Dictionary of National Biography and the History of Parliament. And one of the challenges, apart from the previous challenge I mentioned about getting enough women, is that a lot of the standard words like the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography and History of Parliament, they were written or begun 100 and odd years ago. And although they're being updated, they are still very Whig in their history. You know, Protestants good, Catholics bad, colonialism a good thing. We don't talk about enslavement, you know, so it's a very little mention of the Tudor atrocities in Ireland. Don't really hear very much about that. So I wanted to actually get some much more up-to-date scholarly thinking into it. And I was lucky because I'm a postgrad student, a doctoral student at UCL, I have access to the incredible resources that UCL has, all of the unpublished theses, the journals, the online journals, the state papers online, amazing amounts of data out there if you are in the fortunate position of being able to access them.
Yes, I have to say, as an independent researcher, Melita, you can just imagine the amount of money I spend on books and articles, and just, astounding, really.
I was previously in that position before I started doing the master's for my first book. And and you either physically have to go somewhere and then you can only do so much in a day. So I feel for you, Natalie. I'm just working out how I can click on into being affiliated to the university.
And so you obviously talked about the challenge of, you know, trying to find women to include in your book. Were there any sort of breakthrough moments where you thought, yes, I've found something, you know, or any of those kind of good story, happy moments in your research?
Yeah, what's nice is coming across interesting or not sort of massive breakthroughs, but people I'd never heard of before. Just one that springs to mind, a chap called John Dinham. And he was a minor hanger-on, I think, and Henry VII's retainers. I can't remember offhand, you know, what he did specifically, but he commissioned a wonderful tapestry, which is in the Met in New York. And I've managed to get an illustration of it from the book, but it's just this beautiful tapestry. And you think, well, what was in his life? What was he doing? What was he thinking? Why did he commission this tapestry? And you get these little, they're like little advent calendars, you know, where you open, you get this peep into somebody's life and you can think, well, what was going on around him? So things like that. And discovering interesting woman, Alice something, her name begins with B. She was a merchant in the city of London. She was a merchant's wife, but when he died, unusually, she remained a widow, didn't remarry. But she commissioned a painting of herself and her sons, which is the first picture in English art of a woman reading. But, you know, that's not the Virgin Mary, that is a secular woman reading. So she was quite a hot Protestant. So was she saying something about her religion, or was it just a prop? Is all the questions that it makes you ask about people and seeing them as real people, not as bit parts in the psychodrama of the Tudor monarchs.
Talk to us a little bit about some of those women that you have featured. Maybe if they're the lesser known ones, that would be really great too.
Well, there's one of the most sort of appalling cases in a way, Alice Brigandine. She was, and there are all sorts of tracts and ballads written about this because Alice murdered her husband. She wasn't terribly competent. She was actually the stepsister of Lord North, who was in government both under Mary and under Elizabeth. And she married her stepfather's, one of his apprentices, because he was a city merchant. But anyway, she didn't like him very much. And he was a bit reluctant to settle her jointure on it. So she took a lover, her husband was Thomas Arden. She took a lover called Thomas Moresby. And she made six different plots to murder her husband. There were 10 conspirators involved. In the end, she hired somebody called Black Will of Calais, and he and Moresby went along to murder Arden. Black Will strangled him with a napkin. He then hit him on the head with a tailor's iron, after which Moresby slit his throat. But they were so incompetent that they trailed their bloody footprints all the way to where they threw the body and all the way back again. Mm-hmm. So they were all convicted, and Alice was burnt because she was convicted of treason, not of murder, because for a woman to murder her husband was considered treason. So not a nice story, actually, but so kind of extreme that, you know, you can't help taking notice. Another one I like is Thomasine Bonaventure, her name was. And she came from the West Country, from Cornwall, I think. And she married three master tailors in succession. And the third one was Percival, his name was, and he was Lord Mayor of London in 1498. So she was, you know, high up in the city hierarchy. But she's the first woman below the rank of nobility to found a school. So she founded a grammar school in her home parish of Weak St. Mary in Cornwall. You know, you just think of these women and they've got some money and they've bettered themselves and she's sharing that with her own parish. Most of the women who aren't criminals are involved in education, which is where they're recorded, of course, because they're in the founders list. Another one, Catherine Hussey, she was the wife of Sir Reginald Bray, who was one of Henry VII's key money men. And she was a co-founder, along with her husband and Bishop Alcock of Ely, of Jesus College. And she became responsible for the master's salary. And her Book of Hours is still extant, and it's at Stonyhurst College. Yeah, so there's sort of women. And then there's the woman who allegedly gave birth to cats. And that was quite...
Oh, yes, I have heard that one
before. Agnes Bowker, I think her name was. Yes, yeah, so that was obviously... I think it was Archbishop Parker who said, you know, we know it's a con, but we can't quite put our finger on how they're doing it.
Love it. Really does bring the people to life. That's what I like about these sort of anecdotes. And so in terms of the men, Melita, who did you most enjoy writing about? Were there any sort of standouts?
Well, I have a soft spot for Thomas Tusser. Thomas Tusser, he wrote A Guide to Husbandry and Farming. And he started out as a clerk and he followed the dream, you know, the dream we all have of throwing up the city job and going to the country and running a farm. And he created this beautiful, fascinating book about how to run a farm. And in fact, it was a key resource for the Tudor Book of the Garden, which did as part of Tudor Times. And it's all in verse about what the husband does in March and what the husband and the good wife, she looks after the dairy and the poultry, and it's all in verse, and it's, you know, quite practical. But poor old Thomas, you know, it's a case of do as I say, not as I do, because he did actually go broke and have to go back to the city and take up his clerical job again. But I like him because I like gardening. Another interesting chap is Twm Sean Catti. He's a great Welsh hero. He's a kind of a Robin Hood sort of a character, although I'm not sure he ever gave any money to the poor. But he robbed his victims by conning them. So the most famous story is he stole a bull and dyed its coat, took it to market and sold it back to its original owner. So the original owner, he's leading the bull home, the dye starts to come off and he realises he's been tricked. And he knows it's Twm Sean Catti. So he goes to Twm's house and he gives his horse to a beggar who's sitting nearby. So he gives the reins of the horse to hold while he goes in to look for Twm. Now, the beggar is actually Twm in disguise. So he leaps on the horse, gallops off to the bull owner's farm, says to the farmer's wife, your husband sent me urgently to bring him some money. He's desperate for money. The fact that he's lent me his horse shows how much he trusts me. So she hands over the money. So Twm goes off with the horse and the money and rides off to London. But he does reform. He marries an heiress, settles down somewhere in West Wales and becomes a magistrate and a pillar of society. But yeah, no, he's quite fun, Twm Sean Catti.
That is a good story. That's not one I've heard of. I like that. You're obviously very familiar with this period of history. You've been studying it for a long time as well. But did you still find that you came across things that kind of surprised you, that you weren't very familiar with?
I think probably this isn't something that as Tudor Times we've looked at a lot, is a Tudor Ireland. And I think it's something that has been avoided in history, partly because it is so difficult to write about even now, the contested history. But some of the Elizabethan heroes, I would take Edmund Spenser. Now, I had thought of Edmund Spenser as, you know, the writer. All right. So the Fairy Queen is criminally dull, in my opinion. But, you know, it was a fabulous book at the time and everybody loved it. But the stuff he wrote about the Irish, the racism, the appalling incentive to genocide that was in his works. And so I came across a lot more of that I hadn't really been aware of or not wanted to look at. So that's, and I certainly hadn't associated with Edmund Spenser. Other interesting things. Oh, I think they all traveled a lot more than we thought they did. So you have the idea that everybody stayed in their village and never went far from home. But certainly, not the very poorest people, but even at quite low levels of society, you know, sort of economically, people moved around a lot more than you think they did. They went to the hiring fairs and they went to different farms and they moved around. So that surprised me. And the number of, say, gentry, middle class ranks that travelled abroad. And you do see, I mean, you see it in government, the number of men, I mean, you know, the Tudor new men, they did come from quite humble beginnings, a lot of them. I mean, obviously, Wolsey and Cromwell are the most obvious examples. But yeah, there was more social mobility than perhaps we envisage, certainly for men. Women you know, have to married equal or up, whereas men were a bit more flexible, I suppose.
Yes, I actually came across a similar thing, and now I can't remember where I saw it or read it, but it was along those lines that women actually travelled a lot more for pleasure than we kind of imagined that they did. Of course, it's probably more the middle class women and upper class, but it's really interesting to think of them travelling like we do for pleasure.
Yeah, I wonder actually what they did once pilgrimages were no longer available, because you know, obviously we can see from Chaucer that the pilgrimage for some people it was a religious thing, but for a lot it was kind of a jaunt. So what excuse did they use once they were no longer going on pilgrimage to jaunt about the countryside? They visited their families, they went out to dinner. That always surprises me when you see records of going out to dinner. It just seems such a modern concept.
And so you were talking there about Edmund Spenser, how it seems your opinion maybe has changed a little bit about him since you've been working on your book. So is there any other person or other people who your opinion has kind of shifted since you've written this book?
Probably not, in that the famous people I knew a fair bit about already, and the not so famous people, it was all new, really. I think it's apparent from a lot of the stories, particularly about the women, but of course I am looking at the women who are in the record, that they had a lot more agency than we think. And I suppose all of the anti-women rhetoric that you read is partly because they were doing their own thing and the men didn't like it. Actually, there was one chap, now he's a bit of a hero, actually, another Thomas, because as I demonstrate with my little pictogram of the names, they're all called Thomas. Thomas Eliot. Now, you might have come across him. He was a philosopher, I suppose, a writer. And he was loosely involved with the Duke of Somerset's government under Edward VI. And he wrote a lot of literature about the Commonwealth and how to live in society well. But one of his best known books is on the defence of good women. And he talks about how women are not inferior creatures and they're equal of men and intellectually and so forth. So he does challenge some of the misogyny. But he also asks a really interesting question about how we should live in society and how we should all speak truth to power, and that you should do it even if you know you're going to be punished. Your duty to your prince, to your country, is to speak truth, even if you know that will end in you being punished or in the particularly nasty ways that Tudor governments came up with. So he's a really interesting thinker and concerned for the common good.
Well, I think we like him now. I think we should all look at
Thomas Eliot. Eliot, usually spelt with a Y.
With a Y. I have come across him before, yes, but I haven't looked into his life too in detail. But now I think he deserves that. So, Melita, what other exciting projects are you working on at the moment?
Well, I've got my head down to try and finish the PhD this year. If all goes to plan, I'll be handing it in at the end of the summer. And plan B, it all going perfectly, hopefully I will get my doctorate by the end of the year. That would be the ideal. And I've just confirmed with the publisher of my first two books, Amberley, the third book that I've promised them. So I'll be starting on that. I'll be putting the thesis in the post and I'll be starting on my new book for Amberley.
And that's still on a Tudor theme?
It is, yes. Yeah. I probably won't share it just at the moment, but once I kind of get pen to paper and I can share what's going on.
Oh, wonderful. Well, your books are absolutely wonderful. So I'm sure this one will be just as fabulous. And that is exciting about your PhD. I wish you all the very best with getting that into the mail and ticked off the list. That's incredible. I have one more question for you. I can't let you go without asking you for a Tudor takeaway. So something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode.
This isn't a fabulous Tudor resource at the moment, but if I could just mention my own website, melitathomas.com, where I have information about events, because I will be speaking about 1,000 Tudor people at the Harvington History Festival and various other events. So if you go to melitathomas.com, you'll find events. A useful Tudor resource. I mentioned it earlier, and even with its limitations, it's still very good and it is publicly available. The History of Parliament online. Now, the History of Parliament was God knows how many tomes of Victorian study about every member of Parliament there's ever been. And they are slowly putting it online. And it is so useful for knowing what offices people held, or men, obviously, who they were married to, who their sons and fathers were, who their brothers were, because you quite often see MPs as families, often information about their wills and who their legatees were. So really, really useful database about men of parliamentary rank, which is gentry generally. Couldn't do without the History of Parliament online.
Yes, I agree. I have gone to that website many times and utilised it. So absolutely agree. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to talk Tudors with us.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is on the Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as the Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.